Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Need expert advice on your family's health? Speak to us today at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we'll settle down a bit now because I'm joined by a woman who has some story to tell. The Kilkenny Arts Festival starts in just over a week's time, so it's a very busy time for its director, Olga Barry, who joins me now. Good afternoon, Olga.
Good afternoon, Brendan.
So, Olga, this time last year, I didn't think you'd be back here. I don't think you thought you'd be back here at the helm of the festival. You almost died, I think, 3 times last year, would that be fair?
Yes. I mean, I wasn't acutely aware of that at the time, but that's what I was told afterwards.
Okay. Yeah. So before we get to that, you've had a kind of a very wide and varied career in the arts. You've worked with everyone from Radiohead to the RTE Concert Orchestra.
Yeah, in very different roles. Yeah.
How did you end up in Kilkenny then?
Actually, the previous director had, when he took up the post, they'd advertised for a producer, and I was working in RTE at the time with the Concert Orchestra, and I'd always kind of flitted between ensembles because just being around musicians making music every day or working towards something every day, love it. But festivals, it's like a drug. It's like a kind of high that is... I mean, people who work in festivals have something wrong with them, but also have something really right about them. Because it's such a high, because it's like a total overload of every sense, including your organisational, and all the stuff that moves you. So I'd kind of flitted from one to the other, and I had a hankering to get back into festival life. So I started working in Kilkenny in 2014 as the producer, which basically means getting rid of all the problems around the practical stuff so that artists can, you know, do the thing that they do.
Okay, so your job is everything.
Chief bottle washer usually is what I call it, butler to the band, you know.
You say flitting around there and like looking down your CV, it's a precarious kind of life too, working in the arts, isn't it? And like maybe people don't think about what that actually means in real life, but for example, you're still a renter.
Yes, yeah. Hopefully for not much longer, but yeah, I'm still a renter. And most people in the arts, or a lot of people in the arts, are renters. I don't want to put words in colleagues' mouths, but a lot of people would say to me, it usually is their partner having a different kind of career that allows them as an artist or as a festival maker or as a producer to secure housing. So yeah, it is precarious. But there are stable jobs in the arts. But in the main, they're few and far between. And I also liked moving on. I felt like I was learning in everything I was doing. So I was always kind of chomping to do something new. And I think that's the ideal way to kind of run your life in the arts, if you're sort of generous like I was and am.
Yeah.
It's an interesting journey. But I've also had incredible experiences. And this blip last year made me very aware of how lucky I am and how rich my life is because of the choices I've made. Yeah, working in the arts.
But there comes a point, I presume, then at a certain stage of grown upness, like you haven't bought a house, and I know you say it makes you feel slightly like a failure at a particular point.
Why is that? I guess it's partly maybe it's my upbringing, like that my parents were civil servants.
Yeah,
I never imagined that I wouldn't, if I chose to, be able to own my own home. But I never felt like I wanted to own my own home either. In my naivety, in my 20s, I thought we were going to be very European by the time I hit a certain age. And I would live where it suited me to live if I wanted to not just move jobs, but be in other experiences. And maybe, you know, that's youthful naivety as well. But it did come as a bit of a bolt. And I think, look, you talk about it in your show a lot. You know, the quality of accommodation has gone down. Like when I was in college, I was paying very little money and not great accommodation. But then, like, I lived in very good accommodation as a young renter.
Yeah.
And that just declined because of all the things we talk about all the time to do with housing. All of that kind of... I was also unwell without knowing I was so unwell. You know, there was something underlying going on in my body that I had that hadn't been identified. So lots of things were starting to sort of...
Okay.
Cloud in on me, I would say.
So how in leading up to what you call your blip. So life was busy. I think you right before it, you were working in Washington and all that. You were on the go a lot.
On the go a lot. I think COVID as well, because everybody working in the arts had a, you know, everyone had a kind of existential moment or two with COVID. Then people in certain industries had different kind of realities to deal with. The thing about the arts in Ireland, it is improving, but was very, as I mean, I was going, do we all just get sacked? You know, do we all just pack up our bags now and it's over? Because the idea of trying to run an event or how you might work your way around that seemed very precarious. So, I mean, I was thinking about this in the car. I mean, I'm Gen X, you know, resilience and independence is kind of, you know, our kind of hero thing. And I think I just went into this kind of mode of keep going, keep going, keep going, keep going.
Uh-huh.
That your headspace has shifted somewhat. And Kilkenny actually, it's kind of poor language to say it this way, we had a good pandemic in that we were able to do certain things in the gaps where things were open. We were able to premiere new theatre first. We had outdoor staged opera. But I realise looking back now that I was sort of like slightly manic about whatever we do, we have to keep trying because we can't fail here because we have to find a way to do this. And it was more than COVID. It was the arts was built on sand so much for so long in Ireland.
Yeah.
How fast it crashed, and how quickly it crashed, and how difficult it was for that to be deemed important. So that all got into my head. So I think I was increasingly sort of just keep going, just keep going.
Yeah.
And then you stop.
So kind of dancing as fast as you can. And then, are you looking after yourself in that? Were you like?
It's really funny because like a really good friend of mine, Mary Hickson, used to, when we were working in the O'Reilly Theatre in Dublin together and we were running Crash, and sometimes she'd look over and she'd go, there you are now, worrying away, worrying, worrying, worrying. Like, I don't know, it's just how I am. You know, maybe I can't change that fundamentally, but I almost had a, if you worry enough about things, you can see around more corners and you can solve things before they all crash down. I'm not doing a deal with the devil here, but if sometimes I've run my life that way. If you worry enough about things, you can maybe get away with it.
Didn't, like, something,
and if you didn't, something terrible would happen.
Yeah.
Didn't work last weekend for Cork Hurlers, but you know, I didn't worry enough maybe as I should have for them. And therefore Claire got the jump.
Right. So what happened in March?
So I wasn't feeling well for a while. I was doing that thing in Washington, came back, went to my doctor, and he immediately said, you have double pneumonia, gave me a prescription. And I do, like, the moment, I kind of always felt relieved. Okay, you know, there is something wrong with me. Now I have the solution. Went to the pharmacist. But I remember standing in the pharmacist thinking, jeez, I don't know if I can stand here for the 10 minutes this might take. You know, I sat down and then I went to bed. Picked up milk and bread and bananas and cheese, you know, just to keep you going for a couple of days. And I texted a few people saying, not feeling good, went to the doctor. I actually sent one text. You know, the way, you know, I'm dying, girl. I actually sent a text to somebody saying I'm dying. The way I would any time, with a hangover or whatever, I'm dying. So I get a bit of a kick out of that now, that I did actually, you know. And then I woke up in the middle of the night, like about 4 o'clock, and I really was, like, struggling. Like, hanging onto the banister coming down the stairs. And I dithered a bit before I called the ambulance. I remember thinking, Jesus, like, am I being very dramatic here? You know, you doubt yourself all the time with that stuff. And am I catastrophizing this? And of course, then I'm going, no, I actually really think I need to ring an ambulance here. So I rang the ambulance. And by the time it came, I was out. I wasn't awake. I wasn't conscious when they arrived.
So how did they get into you?
I don't know where I saw this, but I unlocked the door and I said to the dispatcher, I'm sitting on the stairs in the hallway, tell them to come straight in, it's a grey door, I've unlocked the door. I saw it on a soap or something. I saw it on something.
That's a great one, yeah.
It's okay. Like, seriously, word of advice, if you know, particularly if you're on your own in a house, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they have ways of bashing a door in, but it saved the door.
Were you calm in all this, so, like, or were you terrified?
Do you know, I was when I remember thinking, God, this really is not great. And then when the dispatcher said it's going to take, you know, 30 something minutes or whatever it was, I kind of panicked then and immediately regretted not having called an hour earlier, because I could feel it all becoming certainly more anxious for me in that hour. I really couldn't get any breath in. So I did have, I remember thinking very clearly, very logically, this is it, this is how I go.
Okay. And then it kind of escalated when you went
into
hospital.
And then I slept through the next 5 weeks of it. And everybody in my life had a terrible time. But I was mostly blissfully unaware.
So It had progressed to sepsis, correct?
Yes. Now, I'm not exactly sure but when exactly it, the sepsis was like apparent, but they took me to the St. Luke's Hospital in Kilkenny. They checked that there was still something going on in the head because they didn't really know how long. I guess the dispatcher was kind of, you know, once I stopped.
Oh, so you're still out, like?
Completely out. Okay. I have no recollection of any of that. My only, like the first time I remembered being awake, like actually awake and myself, as in it's me, I'm in a place, was in ICU in James's at the very end of April, which is like 5 weeks later.
Okay. So were you in a coma?
Yeah. Induced. You know, you're intubated. So they put you on a ventilator and they basically paralyze, give you a paralyzing agent and then try to figure out what the hell is going on.
Okay, so this was to just stop your body,
to just,
is
well,
it?
To just keep me breathing artificially, basically.
Oh, right. Yeah. So you're on
a ventilator all the time.
Isn't it lucky you didn't know that any of this was going on? You'd completely freak out, wouldn't you?
I would have lost my, absolutely lost it. Sometimes you're better off not knowing.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You know, if somebody sat down and said COVID, you know, when we were told that 2 weeks and said, actually, it's going to be 2 years of really difficult, we'd have all lost our marbles, you know. Mm. So, yeah.
So you were there in a coma and everyone around you, friends and family and everything, it's kind of that kind of sitting with the person in a coma. And
yeah. I mean, they don't.
They're going to come back out of this and all that kind of thing.
All of that kind of stuff. And in the main, they were saying there's something else going on here. There's another, as they're like, there's another core issue going on here. They think that, you know, they were like, we think there's something wrong with her heart. She hasn't had a heart attack. And they did, you know, as many tests as they could. There's some things you can't do, like you can't do an angiogram, you can't do an echogram. But they knew there was something not working correctly with my heart. And it turns out their best estimation of what caused my valve to basically stop working over time was that I didn't have pneumonia as a baby, which I had been diagnosed as a baby, as an infant. I had rheumatic fever and it causes this particular valve, which is normally a hereditary thing, it's a genetic thing. This particular valve was basically not working properly and slowly, it's called mitral valve regurgitation, basically a leaky valve. So the blood wasn't going the right way around, basically most of my life. But because it hadn't been picked up, that on top of pneumonia,
okay,
created this kind of perfect storm.
Tell me about the coma playlist.
I actually did. I mean, I forgot things quickly, even when I did kind of come out. But, geez, I have the best friends in the world. And when you have a career in the arts, I can't believe I'm going to say, like, I still recommend it to people.
Yeah.
Because you have these very intense bonds with people. You might only work on one project. But my sister was like, Jesus, your phone is a joke. Like, who is this now? And I'm like, oh, that's somebody I was in. That's somebody. Because you have these very intense things. So one friend of mine sort of formed a subcommittee to make a playlist and started asking all these different people. And, you know, you're patching this together after the fact. Yeah. It's the most bonkers playlist. Like, it has Massive Attack and it has Henry Purcell. You know, it has Gillian Welch and it has Four Men and a Dog and it has the theme tune to The Sopranos and it has some Avril Perton and Scott Strauss. Richard Strauss. It's really random because he asked all of these different people.
And they were trying to think of stuff that might get through to you. Like,
yeah, I'm one, Linda Buckley, I was sitting with Linda after the premiere of one of her new works at New Music Dublin this year. And she mentioned, oh, and then when Frank rang me, and I was like, did you put something in the playlist? And she was, oh, yeah. And then she was talking about the last time she was asked to contribute something or suggest something for a playlist was also for somebody in a coma. And she picked the Estonian, very wonderful composer, Avril Perth. And then afterwards, you know, it's very slow moving and kind of ethereal.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. A lot of choral music and immediately regretted going, that's going to keep him asleep, even though he loves that work, you know?
Yeah.
So it's a bit
keep
of a,
it lively would be your recommendation for it.
Do you know, it made me laugh. I don't remember ever hearing any of it. I had delirium all the way through. So there's some other memories that are more present from when they were trying to take me off the ventilator and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. So what's that like then?
It's very confusing.
Yeah.
It's very confusing. This might sound a little upsetting, but that thing of feeling that need to say something really important before you know you're going to be drugged. Like it came into the the kind of delirium that I knew I was going to be drugged. I didn't, not because I thought I was in a hospital, like I thought I'd been kidnapped. That's a very common one for people.
This is when they woke you up initially,
is it? This is when they're trying to get you off the ventilator. And okay. That was going on, as I say, for like nearly 5 weeks. So I imagine that was pretty, they're used to it, of course, but the, you know, the patient is not successfully getting off the ventilator. So there's this moment where you're presumably semi-conscious and whatever's going on in your head is, you know, coming to the fore. So like kidnapping is a very common feature in ICU delirium. I thought I was in a TV. When I was more awake, I thought I was in a TV show. I thought this was all sort of being acted, you know, and, you know, I was just waiting for my line. So it's very confusing.
And you remember bits when they you up to the surface a bit and went back down again. Then.
Yes, but I didn't at the time. But what I did, once I could hold a pen properly, I just got a notepad and I started, and I then got to kind of let that go. But there was a good 2 weeks where I would have to say to people, so we weren't in Copenhagen, no? Or we weren't in Australia for
I
that.
I shouldn't be laughing.
Like, oh, yeah, listen, yeah. I get a great laugh out of it. Like I was in a play with Olivia Colman in my head. I thought we were in a very successful play in The Gate, you know, like, which is, and she was wonderful. But, you know, it's just bats. You know, you're trying, I guess it's your brain's way of trying to figure. Somehow, figure out what is going on.
A story. We all need a story, don't we?
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
So there are several attempts then to bring you back, and then there's at some stage it works.
At some stage, they say the best thing for us to do now. This has got to do with the length of your trachea.
Okay.
That because you know other things were improving, but we need to move this on. That's when they decided to give me the tracheostomy, and that meant that the ventilator had a shorter. I don't know the medical reason for this, but that was why they gave me the tracheostomy.
Okay, so initially you had a mask.
Initially I was, tube.
Okay, tube.
And then they put the tube in my neck.
And you're lying there awake with that?
Eventually I was at the time. You know, that was decided. And that's when I started coming out and being able to be off the vent for longer. And basically the road to recovery started was by them putting that in.
Okay.
So I think there was, about a week and a half where I was on the tracheostomy. So I could, you know, I couldn't speak, but I could attempt to write. And that became the kind of beginnings of me understanding. Because like, you know, at one point I was like, where's my phone? Jesus, I better get to Kilkenny. You know, like somebody's going to be really cross at me. I just haven't turned off to work for a week. And then slowly realising it had been much longer than a couple of days.
When you come to terms with that, then that's a bit of a shocker, is it? When you realise what's been going on.
It is a bit of a shocker, but you do slip into kind of, okay, I remember being very kind of anxious initially and then going, okay, I'm going to just sort of yield all autonomy here, which is not in my
nature. I was just going to say, I can tell that wasn't easy for you, yeah.
But actually... And I guess this, you know, I'm constantly sort of saying to myself to remember the positive things. I slipped into gratitude and I'm grand and, you know, just trying to be, go with whatever this is, because this is definitely not something I'm qualified or able to kind of process. So, yeah, I kind of yielded to the wonderfulness of ICU in so many ways. You're in,
really,
I was in a certain amount of pain, but they were just so amazing and kind. I mean, you think about the kind of clinical expertise, but like there's loads of people who are experts and stuff. They're kind of not particularly nice about it. Just that the generosity of people, you know, like conversations afterwards with people, you know, who run the canteen and so, oh, Jesus, I prayed for you. I didn't think we'd see you back. And just that human thing. It's almost like being in a village where everyone is looking after you. It was amazing.
Because From I suppose that we saw a lot of images of it in COVID and everything, ICUs and ventilation and all of that, it all looks very kind of scary, like this alien kind of environment and everybody covered up and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. I wasn't saying I was hallucinating. There were things I thought I saw. I'd had a dream that there'd been a party and that boxes of... champagne were in the corner and like the medical waste bin in my head was just like, I don't drink champagne, terribly old, but like weddings, there was cases of, you know, I kind of almost had my own world in it.
Yeah.
As well. But then when, you know, I started taking first steps, and it was the first time walking out of my sealed bubble room.
Yeah.
And realising, oh my God, like this is, you know, massive.
And do you have to learn, are your muscles atrophied and all that? Do you have to start learning to walk again? And is all that quite similar?
All of that. And actually, I suppose maybe why I'm able to be a little bit glib and a little bit more philosophical is that actually I, you know, they all just, you know, you have incredible powers of recovery. You're doing much, you know, lots of things happen much faster.
Okay.
Than what they, you know, they were sort of saying, you know, there might be a few months of kind of therapy. I pretty much was able to get on with stuff pretty quickly.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I was just on the right kind of age profile, I suppose, if you're going to have something like this.
So the question you want to ask people in these situations is, how did it change you? Before I ask you that broader question, am I getting that one way it changed you was that, like, you were a person who controlled everything and, you know, saw around the corners and any potential problems. Did you have to start falling back into other people and letting them all help you and family and friends and all of that? Yeah.
Yeah. You've actually nailed it probably better than I even consciously thought of, but exactly that. That actually I could rely on people. And of course it was fine to rely on people, but you never really want to test it because maybe you don't really believe it.
Yeah.
You know?
And they came through.
My God, in spades, my colleagues, my professional colleagues, the arts community itself, everyone I'd work with, my family, just like people who still work in the construct came out and took me on my walks, you know?
And your sister, I believe, really came through for you. Did you move in with her for a while?
She bought a house just before COVID kicked in. So she was sitting in a house about to be renovated that nobody could do anything with. She just moved in at Christmas time. And then I rocked up with, here, family crisis. You're going to have to go to James's every day. No, I didn't. But she did. She came to James's just about every day. And then let me move in with her after I had the heart surgery, which was a totally different thing that then got tacked on to the end of all
okay.
of that drama.
So they kind of, they did solve your problem,
they
ultimately.
They completely
yeah, okay.
solved my
yeah,
problem, yeah. 100%.
I mean, you were in a brace then for 6 weeks, were you?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of jokingly call it the suicide vest or the parachute tube, depending on how optimistic you were feeling.
Yeah.
You kind of get, it just kind of holds your chest bone together, because they have to wire, because they have to do it with open heart, they wire your chest bone together. And that's the big thing, is not letting the wires break, because redoing it apparently is like the worst thing in the world.
So did you have to sit still?
Pretty still.
Yeah. How did that go
Turns
for you?
Turns out I'm great at sitting still.
Really? Yeah.
Listen, mindlessness is my new philosophy.
Go on, tell
you
me.
I found myself staring at a wall going, and then I go, look at the watch. Oh, jeez, I've been staring at that wall for 2.5 hours. Not a bother on me. So it is it's your brain, like, doing everything to put the energy into the right place.
Okay, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. See, so the one head doctor could go gave into me great, idle, like.
Exactly. Yeah. One doctor gave me a great piece of advice, which was watch TV shows you've seen already so you don't have to follow the plot. So I rewatched shows like The Sopranos, or, you know, I watched things where I didn't need to be on it, like, 100% to catch a narrative shift or something, you know.
Probably a good thing to learn for a person, an anxious person who was overthinking, to think a bit less, was it?
Yeah, I mean, I have kind of jokingly said it's been a really positive thing for me.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that sounds really Pollyannish, but I have found it to be, I feel it grounded me in some way. It reminded me of more, you know, I'm back in the usual thrust of festival making, but I worry about things, not so much less, but differently, I suppose. That I don't have that if I don't. It's not just instinctive worrying. It's not as pointless a set of worrying. Whereas I expended a huge amount of energy in pointless worrying. So now at least when I'm worrying about something, I think I'm more focused about why I'm worrying about it and what am I trying to solve in that worry. You know, because you need a certain.
That's not worry though, really. Then
not,
that's just
you're right.
actually.
That's just being a grown up.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And. Yeah, well, you see, we're all mad for the kind of wisdom of people who come back from the edge
and
everything.
And
so
I wish I had more.
How has it changed your outlook
on life? And people say that, you know, is it like?
So less pointless worry.
Less pointless worry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Would that be the main thing? Yeah.
I think that would be the main thing. And also, maybe it's a generational thing. Yeah, you can't control everything no matter how hard you try.
I know.
And I've tried, you know.
Yeah.
So, But also, I'm also trying to make sure that that doesn't give me license to blow it all up either. Do you know what I mean? And that was the other thing. I kind of thought, Jesus, am I going to want to totally change my life here? And I really didn't, which is also something that I wasn't valuing something correctly. I wasn't seeing the richness in my life.
You see, you weren't going to run away and join the circus after your coma, because you ran away and joined the circus.
I didn't want to leave the circus more than join.
So are you back to work now, fully functional and all of that, full recovery?
All of that, I mean, it's kind of that bizarre thing where you go and you get this test, you get an echogram, which is whatever it was, 6 months after getting new valve in. You know, and they go, yeah, great, we'll send you an appointment card for a year. And suddenly, that's it.
So the festival is starting August 8th, so a little over a week's time.
That's right.
Are you getting stressed out?
We've Irish National Opera arrive on site tomorrow and start building into the Watergate. So when crew start arriving on the ground, I get tingles, because really, it's about the people who put the sets up. And
It's exciting for you.
It's exciting.
Yeah.
In COVID, that first time we stood in an empty room, you know, apart and going, could we maybe? I had that frisson on of this all makes sense. You know, it kind of makes sense in your life if this is what you love. So, the next 10 days we'll be building in and preparation and artists arriving and building stages into cathedrals and clearing patches of ground for high tower projection shows. And
love it. That's your board. Okay. Well, listen, you've been very generous now. So I'll be generous to you now. Do you want to give us some highlights from the festival this year?
Yeah, thank you. Irish National Opera, double bill, M. O'Halloran, one of a thrilling composer. One of the things I like about Irish National Opera is they're doing contemporary opera. We think of it as being, you know, some people think of grand opera or the canon as being kind of a old fossilized thing.
Okay.
And actually, this is the really exciting thing, is that, you know, it's text from Mark O'Halloran, who we know from Adam and Paul and Conversations After Sex. So it's thrilling. It's theatre with the heightened edition of music. This is a slightly esoteric piece, but Niall Valley, probably one of Ireland's most revered performers, concertina player from Armagh. I won't say good luck Armagh, but good luck Galway and Armagh. He has made a stage show that Tom Creed, Cork director, who happens to be directing the operas as well, he's taken archival recordings from traditional music and he's mixed it in with a live set of musicians and a lot of imagery and projection and a Shan Nose dancer, Shebeil Dabbott, who's kind of doing Shan Nose dancing in a different way. It's almost like contemporary dance, but this is a new production and I'm very excited to see that as well. And one of my favourite, this is free for everybody, we have been commissioning artists to project storyboards onto Kilkenny Castle, and like all of our built heritage is so amazing, you kind of almost forget that it's there. You know, it's like you're a fellow UCC or you'd be walking around, you almost forget that it has all these beautiful places. Kilkenny Castle sits very proudly over the city and you almost forget to look at it. Jack Phelan made an incredible story for it last year around craft, because it was the 50th anniversary of the festival and craft is so identifiably a Kilkenny thing, and he's making a new one this year. So Light Up the Castle, a six-side song, it's got a touch of magic, but it's also celebrating the blocks, the brick that goes into castle making. So free for all the family and a great buzz for the last 4 days of the festival.
And the Kilkenny Arts Festival runs from August 8th to 18th, and more details on KilkennyArts.ie. So listen, there's a lot of texts of people saying that you have been such a champion of the arts. Someone else saying it took her a lot to give up the fags.
That's
the
true.
Wider arts community, Olga Barry, has facilitated so much for creatives in Ireland. We all felt helpless when she got sick, and thankfully the medics and loved one gathered around her and held her hand. An absolute queen in our sector. She will underplay it, but she worked very hard for the sector during COVID in the National Campaign for the Arts. We are also thrilled to have her well and back to her fantastic self. A lot of people from the arts community thanking you for bringing up the issue of housing and health issues, making people in the arts feel like they're a failure, even though they are very successful, says one texter. And another person says, I can relate to those crazy ICU experiences. Being choked, fished out of the sea by fishermen, walking towards the light. Glad to hear your guest has recovered so well. And lots more warm texts. But definitely I clearly didn't realise what an important figure you are in the arts in Ireland, and how much so many people feel they owe you. Kilkenny Festival Director Olga Barry, best of luck with the festival, and stay calm now, stay mindless.
I'll do my best. You'll be welcome anytime.
Email brendan@rte.ie.